When I say I'm in them, I just mean from research purposes.
Sure. Well, if somebody can explain to me the power of Discord, I would love to hear a pitch because I don't get it. And maybe it's just sort of like I'm the wrong generation, but I don't get it.
The Business of Betting podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. 4 out of the top 5 U.S. operators personalize player experiences with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. Learn more about Optimove by requesting a demo at optimove.com/businessofbetting. And if you like what you see, you will get your first month free.
What is up, everybody? I am Jason Trost, the host of the Business of Betting podcast. This is episode 209. Today, I'm joined by Dylan Borghida, who is an ex-VIP insider at DraftKings, FanDuel, was an early employee at FanDuel, knows all the ins and outs about the VIP program. I'm very interested to get into it because even though I've been in sports betting for around 15 years, this is an area that I know very, very, very little about. So it's very new for me. And in many ways, it's a very strange corner of the industry. But before we start, for those of you watching on YouTube, there's a cute little dog sitting behind you on your couch. I was wondering if you could tell the story of the little stuffed animal puppy.
I didn't know if the real puppy was there too. I saw her running back and forth. I think that was just another gift for my fiance. She doesn't like flowers, or at least she alleges that she doesn't like flowers. So I tend to go for the stuffed animals and the cute gifts.
Oh, fantastic. And I also saw that you went to Maryland.
I did, yes.
I don't know if you follow the basketball team, but I want to take the opportunity to gloat a little bit. I went to Northwestern, and I got a lot of satisfaction out of sweeping Maryland this year. So thanks very much for giving us Northwestern fans a big smile on their face.
You guys deserve it. It's been a long, storied history of terrible basketball, and I feel like we've had some decent runs, especially the championship in 2003. Not a big deal. But yes, congratulations on taking advantage of this NIL money that your coach is certainly getting.
I was very proud of the Wildcats. And for those of you that don't know, we went to the tournament for the first time ever twice in a row. So for most programs like Maryland, that's kind of a seriously, that's all you can do kind of thing. But it's a big deal for Northwestern. We've been a basement team forever. And I've been a fan for 20 years, something like that. And we're starting to get good at basketball. And it's quite fun. We got good at football about 10 years ago. And I got good at basketball about 4 or 5 years ago. So it's a nice change. It's kind of like a lot of people forget this, but the Patriots were a horrible, horrible team before, you know, Tom Brady and that sort of era. I guess Drew Bledsoe sort of turned the Patriots around, but the Patriots were a horrible team for like 30, 40 years. And then it's when it got good.
Yeah, I wouldn't get ahead of yourself. Although Chicago is a hotbed for hoops. So you would think Northwestern could pull some strings there, but I'm looking forward to Maryland.
Well, they all go to the better schools. They go to, you know, the Illinois, and Illinois seems to get a lot of the good Chicago kids. But you're right. There is so much talent in the back door that does not go to Northwestern. I think that's changing a little bit, but takes time. Cool. VIP. What is it really?
Yeah. So the VIP teams across the industry, you know, it's all about customer relationships and, you know, the one-to-one communication between the books and their top customers, their top spenders. So you can think of it like, you know, there's the loyalty and rewards programs that exist. Those are super customer facing where people are leveling up tiers and it's really super gamified. When you get to the top level, there's this sort of, you know, behind the scenes aspect of the program where the biggest spenders are receiving one-to-one treatment through a VIP host. They get extra rewards. They're getting game tickets and events. And so it's really adding on to the entertainment for that, for those customers, building loyalty. And the goal is to win share of wallet. It's not to, you know, overextend someone's play. It's to make sure that all the money they are using for their gambling budget is with you or as much as possible.
So, you know, I've been running sports betting. We have two products. We have a sports book and an exchange. And, you know, I've been running the exchange for 13 years now, something like that. And we have never, ever had a VIP program. And to me, it just seems a little bit, what's the right way to put it? It feels very sort of like, I don't know if this is the right decade, but very 1950s, very old school, very clunky, very sort of like, what's the movie where they're playing poker and it's like there's a bank heist or something? Rounders? Is it Rounders or something? Like, I think it's Paul Newman or Robert Redford. I should know it. Anyway, sort of like very old school sort of, you know, I think in the 80s when you were trading in finance, I think brokers used to like brokers in the financial world used to like wine and dine you and, you know, get you drunk and take you to shows and strip clubs and all those kinds of things. But when by the time I was in finance in the early 2000s, all that stuff had kind of washed out of the industry and things were sort of more buttoned up. So like the fact that a VIP program exists in 2024, it feels very sort of anachronistic. Am I like just sort of a way out of touch, or do you think it is anachronistic?
I don't know what that word means, but by the rest of what you said, I can infer. And yeah, I mean, there's an element to that. Like there's an element to the strip club scene and partying, and there is an element to it. I would say that that's a smaller element than people think. I have a quote that I like to use. The one thing better than doing blow with your client is being vulnerable with them. And I wholeheartedly believe in that as a non-drug person. So it really is about building legitimate relationships with these people. And if you can do that, they're way more likely to play with you. And you're building that true relationship. You know, it's their wife's birthday and you send a nice gift. And so it's really just giving them the opportunity to have a face with the book. They have a 24/7 access to you. And I thought you were going to go with the word predatory, which I have heard and I can see. And I think there's an aspect of that too, that probably needs to be cleaned up. But, you know, I think for the most part, VIP programs across the US are really solid. And it's more of like an account management program, like you would see at, you know, a B2B software company versus the old school, you know, everyone's getting trashed every weekend. That's a lot less of it.
So the thing that kind of keeps popping up in my head, and maybe it's just sort of like I see everything through the financial lens, but it sort of sounds like wealth managers, like, and I don't have one. I'm not rich enough for wealth manager, but this sort of like that personal attention, they know you like stuffed animals, so they send you a stuffed animal for your birthday kind of thing.
Exactly.
What industries still operate like that? Can you think of other parallels?
Yeah, I mean, wealth management's definitely one, and when we're trying to acquire these VIPs, we're looking for similar industries that we can either draw parallels from or even find similar clients. And so wealth management's one. I'd say like the private jet industry could be one. People, you know, say like club promoters where they have these high roller clients that come in and spend money. So I think some of that still exists. Most of what goes on between a VIP host and their clients is like a discussion about bonuses or discussion about things that go wrong on the website. It's really like having your full-time customer support agent. And then, you know, a small percentage of the time it's, can you get me a reservation at this restaurant? Or, you know, for the really big guys, can I come to the Super Bowl? But most of it is an interaction about the gameplay through the app and all the issues that could possibly come up.
So when you're describing sort of a VIP program being like super good customer service, personalized customer service, shall we call it, with somebody with like high EQ, you know, another parallel I guess I'm kind of thinking about is a little bit like the Disney World VIP experience where you spend $5,000, you can bring 10 of your closest friends and, you know, you have somebody from the Midwest with high EQ that walks you around in the back behind all the rides kind of thing. So that totally makes sense. But I guess to use the language of wealth management, I think you have to have $5 or $10 million to go with Goldman Sachs wealth management or something of that order of magnitude. What do you need to do to get, like, what are the tiers? I imagine there's different tiers.
Yeah, it's different across the books. The way most people have it set up is like there's a pretty sizable population of like lower end VIPs who may not even have a one-to-one host. That's more like a one-to-many. So they'll have, you know, a VIP customer support line or some email address where they can get expedited service, but they're not being handheld by one person. They wouldn't know Dylan as their guy. They just know that they have service. As far as spend, if I were to put like an average spend on that lower tier, it's probably someone that's playing between, you know, 10 and 20,000 of handle per week. But then that, you know how it is where it's exponential. Like the one percenters of the 1% are playing 5-10 million a week. And so they're the ones that are truly, truly getting that white glove service. And, you know, they have the more seasoned VIP hosts that are taking care of them every step of the way. How do you guys, like, I'm sure you have, since it's an exchange, you have the whale side, you know, matching with the sharps. Is there not personalized attention to the whale side?
No. And maybe it's a bad approach, but I've always built the business like thinking of a sort of like a generic tech business, you know, like the whales of Facebook or the whales of Uber or the whales of Amazon don't get specialized service. They use the same thing that everybody else uses and they're on the same rails and they're just power users.
Is that true, though?
I don't know if, I mean, maybe there is a VIP program for Uber. I know in the frequent flyer industry, like there's sort of that upper, you know, the Delta 360 and the, I forget what the other programs are called. Maybe the airline industry, there's a parallel here with the VIP program where you get personalized booking and you have somebody personal that you can call for your reservation needs. But yeah, it's never something we've done. I think partially because of that sort of like the tech angle, partially because, you know, I used to be a trader and I used to, you know, I'm a techie kind of, I have a techie background. And so I've always been obsessed with price and building the platform and not on the human element side of sports betting. So do you think it's a big fuck up on our part? Like, do you think every sports book needs one of these white glove corners?
I don't think you need it, but I don't see how it could hurt. I mean, if Smarkets is the one exchange that the largest whale players in the country have that relationship with, and they're able to go out to dinner with someone who's their guy, I can't help but think that that helps with loyalty. And I do think this exists across even some other like consumer products. I would assume that a company, I'm completely using this as an example, but like a company like Nike, if they have certain customers that are buying millions and millions of dollars worth of sneakers every year or product, that they're going to take care of those on a more personalized level. And they probably have an account manager and a contact. So I think it happens probably more than we think. I'm like you. I'm not the guy that's dropping or that has $5 to $10 million with a Goldman Sachs rep. So maybe you and I aren't privy to it, but I think that this is existing in a lot of areas.
Yeah, I guess if you view it like concierge is the word that gets thrown around now. You know, you hear of concierge medicine where, you know, instead of waiting in the emergency room, you get to get a doctor right away. You know, you spend $100,000-$200,000 for access to a private doctor. So yeah, I guess I'm warming up to this idea that it might not be as anachronistic as I might have thought about as it was before. So going back to, well, I guess just to answer your question, why a Smarkets might not do it. Like, I mean, maybe when you're a bigger company, this is less of an issue. But when you're a small company, you have to be very careful about the things that you put your focus on. And maybe I'm completely off base here. But my hypothesis, if you take Betfair as an example, Betfair Exchange, I don't know if you followed it too closely from the United States, but Betfair Exchange in the early 2000s kind of took Europe by storm. It was a betting exchange. It was like, it was amazing technology, years ahead of everybody else in the sports betting field. And I actually think Betfair had an opportunity to kind of be like the Google of sports betting. Like, they had an opportunity to run circles around traditional sportsbook. They had better technology, better pricing. They had the kind of the buzz of it being a tech company, all these kinds of things. Like, Bet365 was still, you know, nothing compared to Betfair. And what they did was, instead of like doubling down on their product and making their product and tech better and better and better, they added poker. And I think poker was sort of their gateway drug to being sort of a mediocre everything to everybody gambling company. And so it's a long way to say that I think you might say that there's no harm in having a VIP program because, you know, why not have concierge for your best customers? And you might be totally right. But the reason I might say it's not a good idea is because once you start thinking differently, you sort of start to shift your focus, whether it's conscious or unconscious. And I like to think our North Star is price, product, tech, price, product, tech, price, product, tech, and anything that's not price, product, tech, we don't want to focus on it. So that might be one reason. And to a certain extent, I might think that FanDuel and DraftKings, I imagine they make heaps of money from this because I, you know, there's lots and lots and lots of rich people in the United States. And I'm sure a big chunk of them like to bet on sports and a big chunk of them like to bet a lot on sports. So I'm sure that FanDuel and DraftKings make a big chunk of money. But you can imagine that if you make so much money from concierge services, VIP services, that you start to think of yourself, you're more in the people business. You're not in the tech product business anymore. You're more in the relationship business. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just sort of like, what kind of company do you want to build? And that would be a main reason to not get into it. Although I could just be stubborn and stupid.
No, I think that makes sense. And I would also say up until the past year or so, I don't think VIP was that large of a focal point at any of the operators. I think now that the numbers have stayed true where, you know, the top 1% is doing 40-50% of the revenue, I think now there's an added focus that everyone believes that's going to sustain, as I do. But I still think like DraftKings and FanDuel would say that they're tech companies, not a people company. One other thing I would say is like VIPs in the US especially are not price sensitive whatsoever. So it's like maybe there's a different reason that people are matching on Smarkets versus playing on FanDuel or DraftKings. I've never once heard one of these VIPs who's betting 50K plus a game compare a price versus what Prime Sports is doing or what Sport Trade's doing. Like, it never comes up. So that could be like just a market difference between the two places.
So why do you think VIPs are not, or high rollers, if you like, why do you think that they are not price sensitive?
I think some of it is just what they're used to. So if you're used to playing on the PPH, you know, local bookie sites, unless you're sharp, unless you're one of these professionals, you're not really going back and forth checking for the best price. You're just betting through the person that gives you the best experience, where you can get your money in and out quickly. So I don't think it's been something that these whale players have thought about offshore at all. And when you do think about it, like, there's going to be sharp people who are listening to this that feel the complete opposite. They're sharp. They're not the customers that the VIP programs want. And so that's why they are thinking of price. And I still think that there's so many more of these gamblers that are still playing offshore. They're still playing with local bookies than playing on DraftKings and FanDuel. So, like, to me, that's the competition rather than the competition being, you know, Penn and Fanatics and, you know, Caesars MGM.
So going into the weeds a little bit, what are the different tiers? Like, are there 3 tiers, 4 tiers, 5 tiers, 1 tier?
Totally depends on the site. I'd say most have between 4 and 5 tiers, where your top 2 or 3 tiers would be considered VIP. But it's all about how you segment it. The top tier is going to be the one where everyone in the top tier should have a one-to-one VIP host. You know, the second tier, if you're a large company like DK, FanDuel, MGM, I assume that they're all hosting most of the people in that second largest tier, and then it could drop off from there. But if you're one of the smaller books and you only have 2 VIP hosts, or, you know, 0, or just the founder, then it's going to be a lot less and you're only taking care of a handful of guys.
Let's go into the top tier a little bit, because people love to know what rich people do. So how many people will a VIP, what would you call yourself? An agent? Relationship manager? What's your title on the company side?
It could be VIP manager. It could be player development executive. Yeah.
So if you take the top tier VIP manager, how many clients does that person have? What's sort of the ratio?
Yeah, usually at the top levels, you'd have, you know, 100 to 200 is solid if you're managing the really top players. Some VIP managers have a larger book of business. There's some, you may hire somebody who has like a hybrid role and they're only taking care of your 20 largest players. And like, that's the true concierge person, who could also maybe be like a hunter, where they're managing the top 20 players and they're also trying to find new business through those relationships. So really everyone has it structured completely differently, and the job titles are all over the place. So there's not really like an industry standard here. It's still so new, but those are some frameworks that can work.
But if you have between 20 and 100, that's quite a lot of girlfriends' names and birthdays, and that's a lot of people to get to know and be best friends with.
I agree. And I think most VIP, I don't want to shit on everyone, but it feels like most VIP hosts, like, if you have a book of business of 200, you are mainly speaking to 15 to 20, like your top 10% is who you're really building that type of relationship with. And the rest of the players are sort of email, text based. And some guys don't even answer, or girls. Some players just never answer you. And so those are easy ones to take care of.
Okay. So you have the high Q, high touch, high availability aspect to it. Like, what are the motivations for, you know, I guess, what are the perks? What else is happening in that relationship between, like, hey, John, happy birthday, let's go to dinner at your favorite steak restaurant in Chicago or whatever. But like, what are the other aspects of the relationship that happen?
A lot of it is like, based on their gameplay, you may have different touch points. So if they win a large wager, if they win a bunch of money, like, that's a signal to reach out and have a conversation. Something that I do think companies can move away from a little is like reaching out
for estate planning or what?
No, you're just like, congrats on the win, you know, go Buffalo. Josh Allen had a sick game. You're just talking about sports with the guy. Sometimes if a customer loses, that's when they get hit up with deposit bonuses. I think companies can do a better job of being less predatory in that aspect, but that would be like, you know, a flag to try to get that customer back on. But mainly it is that support. So it's, you know, a guy's tennis player retires in the middle of the first set and they complain to you. How does the VIP rep handle that situation? Do you throw the person a free bet? Do you say, I'm sorry, tough luck? And so those are some of the most common situations. Or the app goes down for 10 minutes and the person claims they wanted to put a big bet in. It's like, those are situations that you have to decide how to handle.
So what percentage of the role, I guess I'm mainly talking about FanDuel, DraftKings, and you can be vague about individual policies or whatever, but like what percentage of the role is sort of like high touch customer service and what percent is sort of wining and dining? Because the way you're describing it makes it sound like it's more customer service, but like high EQ customer service.
I think that is the case. I think for most VIP hosts, especially, it's 85% high touch customer service and, you know, 10-15% the wining and dining. Like, you're not trying to spend crazy amounts of money. These people have budgets. It's not super extravagant other than, you know, the top guys. So 85%, I'd say.
Got it. And I remember, you know, from listening to your podcast that you did with Brad on zero latency. And if those of you that want to know more about this, please go check out that podcast episode. It was a good episode. You were talking about one of the main motivations for all the business going offshore was the fact that they can offer credit. And I totally can understand why that is a big plus for U.S. regulated sports folks. To be honest, I don't think there's any reason why credit shouldn't be allowed, at least to qualified people. Kind of ridiculous that that's the strict purview of illegal offshore books. But do you have other reasons that offshore books might have a competitive edge over regulated onshore books, or is that the principal reason?
Credit to me is the number one reason. When we're going out speaking to these large players, even in legal gambling states, the number one hurdle is that they have to post up the money. And then there's different friction points that come from that as well. So not only do you have to post up the money, but if it's a significant deposit, you most likely have to send in bank statements, and some people don't want to do that. There's the anonymity and privacy aspect that some people are concerned about. And then you have taxes that comes up a lot. Even though, you know, a lot of these people are losing gamblers, as a gambler, you're hoping and almost expecting to win every year. And if that does happen, you don't want to get hit by the tax man. And so, yeah, credit, anonymity, taxes, but credit's the biggest one. I always say, you know, I could make two texts right now to someone who has no clue who you are and get you a massive credit line with a local bookie. Who knows if you'll be paid out, but you'd at least have that shot at glory. Whereas on a legal book, you actually have to wire us the money.
Got it. One of the super interesting things about tax that people might not appreciate the subtlety, but in the UK, sports winnings, gambling winnings are tax-free. So if you win the lottery, you don't pay anything on your gambling winnings. So if you win $1 billion on whatever, Euro Millions, good for you. You get to keep all of it. And I asked regulatory lawyer, like, why is this? This seems ridiculous. And he said, because most people lose money gambling and the HMRC did not want people to deduct their losses. So I'm pretty sure, and don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure in America, if you lose money gambling, you can deduct it from your income. I probably should know about this. But basically, if your winnings are taxed, which they are, that means your losses are tax deductible. You know, you can deduct it from your income. And I'm pretty sure that's the case because it's a symmetrical thing. You know, you can't tax the winnings, but let people not deduct the losses.
Yeah, it might be right, but people aren't expecting to lose. So they're like, you're only expecting to win, which means you're going to have to pay up if you play legally, which is the case. But I'm curious, can you guys offer credit, lines of credit?
Not in the UK, no. And as far as I know, all the jurisdictions that we have licenses in, you can't offer credit.
Yeah, and I think that's a good thing. I think it would be absolute mayhem if credit was legalized or if credit was able to be used by the legal books, especially online. I think it would just be absolute mayhem.
So I guess in one of the important topics of the day is responsible gambling, which I think is still quite a new topic in the US, but it's been a pretty big topic in the UK for the last 5 years or something. To me, it's sort of there's two strong cases on both sides of the coin. On one side, you have personal responsibility. They're adults. People should be able to spend money however they want. On the other hand, you have something that's potentially addictive. People can get over their skis and lose a lot of money very fast. And unlike drugs and alcohol, the pernicious thing about sports betting is that you kind of do it in secret. Like, I guess it's not really good that, like, if you have a cocaine addiction or you're an alcoholic, it's pretty hard to hide that. But it is a lot easier to sort of hide a sports betting addiction. So, you know, like you can hide it, it can go longer, you can lose a lot of money really fast. So I definitely see both sides of the issue. What's your sort of take on it, having been on the inside and seeing a lot of these people who are probably, to be frank, a lot of them are betting more than they should be betting?
It's a very real problem in the industry. It's super nuanced and tough to solve. I think right now there's too much onus on these individual customer support representatives or VIP representatives who are having the communication with gamblers, and those transcripts can be leaked, like we saw in this Wall Street Journal piece. In some of these cases, you're relying on, you know, a mid-20s person who may have never even placed a bet in their life. They just have solid EQ skills, like you mentioned earlier. And now they have to be the arbiter of truth based on what this VIP client is texting them back. And they're the ones that have to flag this behavior and raise it to the responsible gambling team. And if they don't do it correctly, they can get fired and they can get in trouble and the companies can get fined. Like, that just doesn't make sense to me. It's going to be impossible to curb responsible gambling in that way. So I think more onus should be on either a third party or the states and regulators to help the books figure this problem out. And like, as we all know, the books aren't exactly incentivized to curb that behavior either. And so it doesn't make sense from a lot of angles the way it's being approached right now. But I will say that I think legal gambling has a lot better chance at helping curb this behavior than allowing those same people to continue to play with local bookies where they can run up credit lines. Like, that's not the right way to go about it either. So hopefully this can continue to be addressed. I know in the UK, it's like there's been a crackdown on VIP in general, right?
Well, we have a team that goes through and we flag all the customers that we think might be potentially problematic. And we have a responsibility, according to the regulator, to track down people's affordability and make sure that they have the money and are, you know, sound mind to be able to lose this money. So to your point, it might not be the best solution, but it is the solution that's going on in the UK. There is no third party that does this. The government doesn't help. Also, the UK government, the UKGC or the GBGC, I should say, gives very loose guidance on it. They don't give you thresholds and numbers. They give you more sort of a duty of care, is sort of the phrase that you'll hear in the UK. And duty of care is a nebulous thing to say, like, should a reasonable person be allowed to bet or not? And it's up to the company to kind of come up with these thresholds. And it's quite complicated and cumbersome and also a huge operational overhead. So you mentioned third party or governments. Like, what would you want a third party or government to do?
Well, I think what happens now is there's some semblance of affordability checks for the most part. It's definitely different across companies. I've had gamblers say that they've been able to wire in 50, 100 grand without providing any statements in the past, whereas other books are asking for a bank statement, utility bill, you know, everything that you can provide. So I think for the most part now, people are getting those initial bank statements to make a determination on how much money a person can have or if they can afford their deposit. I think what's trickier is when you get someone who's depositing $1,000 at a time, they're basically never getting flagged. They could end up losing 27 grand, which to the book doesn't seem like much when you have guys spending millions at a time, but to that individual, you know, is a lot more than they could afford. And those are, I don't know how the book is supposed to honestly catch that. Like, 27K to someone could be peanuts. 27K to someone else could be their entire livelihood. And there's really no way, unless you're checking at like consistently, and no one wants to provide the sports book with that information consistently. So my thought is, maybe if it was state run or if there was a third party, people would be potentially more likely to give that type of access. But maybe there isn't a good tech solution for this at all. I don't know.
Well, I guess you could have ask for an API to the IRS to see how much money somebody's making, to see if it's a flyer. But in the UK, we have to validate it. So if you want to lose 27K, we have to make sure that you can lose 27K. So we have to look at pay stubs and tax forms and bank statements. And it's quite messy. And we lose a lot of customers. And a lot of sports books have lost tons of customers because of this. And I completely sympathize with the customer. It's fucking annoying to send all this document. I had one customer write in to say he had to give less documentation to buy a house than he did to bet with SmartGoods. And yeah, to me,
you're pushing those people offshore, which isn't good either.
Yeah. And the regulator knows this, but I think they're sort of like, you know, that those two sides of the coin, they're sort of caught, because on one hand, you sort of have the gambling, you know, gambling is the devil, go fuck yourself and let's prohibit it, to the libertarians who are like, adults should be able to do whatever they want. And the gambling regulator sympathizes with them a little bit. It's caught in the middle and has to make both constituents happy. And so they're trying to draw this line. And I think I don't think it's drawn in the right place. And I don't have an elegant solution. I tend to think that more of the responsibility should be on the individual. I think the gambling in the UK, they're putting too much onus on the operator. But as we see, you know, if people are left to their own devices, a lot of people can make bad choices.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'd like the responsibility number one is the person in my eyes. I think most people believe that, at least that I've heard. And then it gets to the next step about like, how do you do anything about it? Are you supposed to do anything about it? And to me, the book's responsibility is to not prey on that. Like, don't be predatory. Don't try to squeeze every last dollar out of your customer. And some of that happens. And that's what the book should control. But then as far as preventing that individual from losing more than they can, yeah, I also don't have an elegant solution.
As somebody that's had an inside view of two of the top books in the U.S., what's your prediction about where this goes in the next 5-10 years? Do you think that they're going to be number one and number two in 10 years? Do you think it's going to change a lot? Do you think it's going to be more of the same?
I think FanDuel and DraftKings have a massive head start. Like, these are true tech companies. I just made the analogy that FanDuel and DraftKings are closer to like Google and Meta than they are to Penn and Caesars. Like, if you go into their office, it is a tech culture, it's a tech company. And I think that has been a bigger edge than people think. I think a lot of their success has been attributed to the daily fantasy sports databases, which are great, but like, MGM has an awesome database, Wynn has an awesome database, and they didn't do anything. So I think it really has been some of the tech execution on the product. So I think they have a huge edge. I also see the market when I spend a lot of time with interacting with Gen Z, and I'm in these discords, and it's clear that single game parlays and these like lotto type of bets are the thing of the future. It's what's talked about on social media. It's what they all want to play. And FanDuel has captured that first with SGPs. DraftKings has obviously, you know, copied it. And so I think the future of betting is not these large straight bets or large in-game plays. I think it's the risk a small amount to win a lot. And whoever can gamify that in the right way has a great shot. And, you know, DraftKings acquiring Jackpocket might be some like a way to merge the two. Who knows? But that's the direction I see it going with the Gen Z, the future VIPs.
As a Gen Xer, I do not get Discord. Like, I grew up on AOL chat and Prodigy chat. And I love me a good chat. You know, I even used IRC back in the day. But every time I look at Discord, I'm like, what the fuck is this mess? There's like smiley icons everywhere. It's got this garish purple and pink. Can you explain to me the appeal of it?
I mean, I don't know. I'm with you. So I just started learning about this stuff like 6 months ago. Did some consulting work with a company that worked with a lot of these top Discords. And so I had a crash course. I'm on a Discord video call with a high school kid who's managing the whole thing. And I mean, it's the new AOL chat room. That's the best way to describe it. And these kids are coming home from school or class in college and they're hopping on. They've got the Discord on one screen. They've got the sports books up on the other screen. And they're in the lab, as they say, and they're building these massive parlays. They're not really scheming about the big game tonight. They're trying to figure out, you know, how to combine a bunch of legs. And that's all the discussion that happens in the Discord. But Discord's just a chat room, and it's what the kids are on.
Well, it's not just a chat room. It's a garish purple loud chat room that doesn't seem very conducive to chat. And all the rooms I go into, it never seems like anybody's having normal conversation.
It's a gamified chat room with lots of pictures.
Yeah, nobody's really chatting. They're just sort of like, check this out. Look, lol. You know, like, it's just stupid chat. All right. Well, I guess I'm getting old.
When I say I'm in them, I just mean from research purposes.
Sure. Well, if somebody can explain to me the power of Discord, I would love to hear a pitch because I don't get it. And maybe it's just sort of like I'm the wrong generation, but I don't get it. I never got Snapchat either. I'm just sort of like, who wants to do sort of like pictures that last 3 seconds? I'm like, I don't get that. Before I let you go, what do you want to be when you grow up?
This is an easy question for me. I know you ask everybody. I didn't mention that this is my favorite podcast, so what an honor. I started tweeting like 6 months ago. I don't even know why I started doing that. Most of my best friends aren't like gambling industry people, so I just wanted community and people to talk about it. And now I'm on my favorite podcast, so that's great. Shout out to Jake. What do I want to be when I grow up? I want to run a awesome basketball facility that is part like the mecca of youth hoops in Maryland, where I'm from and live. And part kind of like adult country club for basketball, where we've got, you know, 3-point contests for adults and people like me that don't play golf but love hoops. And so that's going to be my spot. It'll probably launch in about 10 to 15 years, and you got the open invite.
Holy shit, that is a great answer. That's a great vision. It sounds like something that would be fun to go to. You know, especially like a birthday party where you kind of get sick of like just going to a bar and drinking. Like, let's go do 3-pointers. And by the way, you should not wait 10 to 15 years to do that. You should do that now. That's totally doable now.
You think? Okay. Well, I need to, I don't know if.
You got to write a business plan. You got to figure out how much money you need. Go raise some money. Go buy a lot. Go buy an abandoned lot in Maryland somewhere. And it's cool. That's a very cool dream. I like that.
Thank you. The reason I say 10 to 15 years is because I'm not sure how profitable this thing is going to be. It's going to be more of a passion play, but anyone these days can write a business plan that pretends to be profitable. So maybe I will take you up on that and make it happen.
Well, you can kind of do it sort of like a different spin on Dave and Buster's, you know, just sort of like instead of like arcade games, it's more like burgers, watch sports, but like go play sports while, you know, during halftime or something. Anyway, it's cool. I dig it. And I think it's more achievable than you probably think it is.
I think, I mean, it's happening. It's just, I thought it was a longer timeline, but you're giving me some inspiration.
No. I think now-ish is a good time.
Awesome.
All right, Dylan. Well, thanks very much for stopping by. Thanks for educating me on VIPs. I learned a ton of stuff that I probably should have known a long time ago, but I'm glad to have learned it now. And it's a great perspective on the industry and something new for me. And hope for the listeners, it was something new for you guys too.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. A lot of fun talking to you after hearing your voice all these years or episodes. So yeah, appreciate you.
Awesome. All the best.
The Business of Betting podcast is presented by Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. 4 out of the top 5 U.S. operators personalize player experiences with Optimove, the number one CRM marketing solution for the iGaming industry. Learn more about Optimove by requesting a demo at optimove.com/business of betting. And if you like what you see, you will get your first month free.